Live from the Chase Family Studio at Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This is the site of our third Health Equity Forum. It's a project we've been working on for a few years now with our partners at Connecticut Health Foundation. It's meant to explore the idea of health equity in Connecticut and also as a national issue. How do we make sure that everyone has the best possible health outcomes, regardless of race, regardless of how much money you have? It is a tricky issue for policymakers, which is why we're so glad to have as the basis for our conversation tonight a new set of information called the Connecticut Healthcare Survey. Six organizations came together to put out this report: Aetna Foundation, Children's Health Fund of Connecticut, Donahue Medical Research Foundation, Foundation for Community Health, the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, and Connecticut Health Foundation. We will have links on WNPR.org to all this data so that you can dig in yourself and find out how healthy Connecticut is. It's a set of data drawn from some 5,400 households interviewed. One of the major themes is that even with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which was the subject of our last healthcare forum, there is still a long way to go for everyone in our state to really get the access to health that they need. So our question today, how healthy is Connecticut? Later on, we'll be asking, how healthy are our children? I want to welcome in Dr. Jack Hoadley, who's from the Georgetown Health Policy Institute. He's an analyst and author of a policy brief on health inequities and the safety net as part of this data set. Dr. Hoadley, thank you very much for coming up from Washington today. Thanks for joining us here on Where We Live. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Maybe you can tell us first about the part of this healthcare survey that you worked on.
So I looked at various parts of the survey with a particular focus on where we see differences in both access to health insurance, health status, and ability of people to receive health care, and how that differed across different racial and ethnic groups.
What are some of the major findings, the things that really jumped out at you?
So one of the things that really jumped out is that there is a difference in health status between whites, blacks, and Hispanics. Certainly overall in the state of Connecticut, blacks and Hispanics tend to have lower health status. They have greater risk of diabetes and obesity. They also are less likely to have health insurance, but one of the things that's interesting is that the differences in health insurance are not as great as you might expect, partly because of the safety net of health insurance we have in this country and in this state.
So some of what you just said we have heard and we've talked about quite a bit as we discuss health equity here. What's the new in this for the people of Connecticut? Because we hear, and we don't like what we hear, but we hear these statistics over and over again about the health outcomes. What jumps out at you as new in this data?
So I think what's new is we're really looking at this as a baseline to see what's going to change with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And so we see things about people's health insurance that shows that we still, prior to the start of the Affordable Care Act, because these data were collected before the new health insurance was available to people, we see that there were differences, and it's going to give us an opportunity over time to see how much improvement we get out of the new insurance that people have been signing up for under the Affordable Care Act.
And I know that that's one of the things that we do want to talk quite a bit about how much change we've seen and how much change we're going to see over time. I'm not asking you to make predictions here, but from where you sit and taking a look at this data and the other things you study, what sort of impact do you think the Affordable Care Act is going to have here in America? Have we overstated what it's going to do for people who have had worse health outcomes in the past?
I don't think we've overstated it, although there's work to do to make that reality come true. We really get two things happening through the Affordable Care Act, things that we're measuring in this survey as the baseline. One is that thing I've already mentioned, which is the ability to have people get health insurance coverage. But health insurance coverage alone doesn't get people health care. It gives them the sort of ticket to get them health care. And what happens, even for people who don't have insurance, a lot of them still do get health care, but they struggle with it. It costs them money. They have to go to certain places to get it. What we're really looking to see happen under the Affordable Care Act is not only do they get that health insurance, but that it provides them access to health care providers without some of the financial burdens they might have faced in the past. And because it's the minority populations that are more likely to have those gaps, this may cause and bring to fruition some reduction of that gap in care and gap in coverage that we've seen in the past.
Stand by for a moment, Doctor, because I'm going to come back to you in just a moment and try to get a little bit of a sense about where Connecticut might stand nationally, because obviously the entire country is going through this process right now. But I want to welcome in Dr. Jeanette Ikovics with the Yale School of Public Health. She's a professor of epidemiology. She's also director of the Community Alliance for Research and Engagement Care, and she's the author of a policy brief on access to care as part of this healthcare survey. Doctor, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, John.
So tell me a bit about what you were working on as part of this healthcare survey.
So we were working, as you said, on the brief around access to care more generally. We were leaving to Jack and his colleagues the focus specifically on disparities, and we tried to take a larger lens. When we think about the Affordable Care Act and we look at some of these data, in the work that we did, perhaps the most one of the most important things was that 1 in 10 residents said that they did not get the care that they needed, and 3 in 10 said that they delayed getting the care that they needed. Mm. And when we look at the disparity between those insured and uninsured, we see those rates double and triple. So, for instance, more than 50% of Connecticut residents who are uninsured delayed getting the care that they needed. What this means practically, as we think about expansion of Access Health Connecticut and the Affordable Care Act, is the issue of prevention. If people are delaying the care or not getting the care that they need, then we miss opportunities for primary prevention, keeping healthy people healthy, and also for secondary prevention, that is early detection, diagnosis, and treatment.
Why are they delaying care?
In a single word, cost. And people are raising concerns about cost in all segments of our respondents, both those who are uninsured as well as those who are insured.
This idea of how much health care costs, even though now people have access to it, we have access to theoretically health care that's affordable for more people, cost is still the big issue. Talk a little bit more about that.
Cost is always going to be an issue, and I think especially in Connecticut, as we sit here in a forum of health equity, we know we have tremendous wealth disparities, and with that come consequent health disparities. And we see another kind of fact from the data that I found quite important was that 27% of people who are self-employed actually were uninsured, and this is strikingly close to the proportion of unemployed residents who were uninsured.
Jack, do you have a quick thought?
Filling a prescription is one of the places where, first of all, we see some significant racial disparities. It's really twice as many people who say they didn't fill a prescription because of cost for blacks and Hispanics versus whites. And you think about how that works. You walk into the pharmacy to get your prescription, and when they come back and tell you that prescription's, you know, $2, you probably walk away with the prescription. But when you go into the pharmacy and they say, oh, this particular prescription is going to cost you $45, some people are going to not have that money and not going to be able to afford it and walk away and leave that drug back on the counter. And that may be a drug that's really important to either saving their lives, maintaining their health, or causing them to have fewer symptoms with whatever condition they're dealing with.
And again, I'd like to sort of pull the lens back from time to time and say, importantly, let's get to them before they need the drugs. Let's talk about primary prevention. And that, you know, when we talk about a social safety net, it's a healthcare safety net, but it's a social safety net. And we think about the many, many sort of sectors of society that really play an impact, from education, transportation, agriculture, you know, our retail and business community, our faith community as well.
We're talking today about health equity. It's our third health equity forum in conjunction with the Connecticut Health Foundation. On this program, we're talking about the Connecticut Healthcare Survey, a big data set put together by 6 funding organizations trying to figure out how healthy Connecticut is. In this part of the conversation, we're talking about some of the broad findings here, but we're also going to be talking about how healthy Connecticut's children are later on in our show. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. We're talking with Dr. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown, Dr. Jeanette Ikovics from Yale School of Public Health. I want to welcome into our program Reverend Dr. Shelley Best, who's president and CEO of the Conference of Churches. And Reverend, first of all, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
I know that a lot of what we've already talked about so far are things that you want to talk about that resonate with you. But give me your broad sense about what you see in this survey. What are the most important issues that you're pulling out?
I think what's powerful in the survey is it's revealing some of the things that most of us that are on the ground working with the everyday people already know. We know that cost is the major factor when it comes to people accessing health care. And this is before health care reform, and this is currently as well. Things have not really changed that much for the working poor. So while we do have access to health care now, for the working poor, the system is still not very accessible. When you're looking at a family bringing home maybe $300 a week, working, you know, a minimum wage kind of position, when you look at the amount of money they bring home and they have to pay their rent, they have to buy food, and now they have access to health insurance. Well, that's great. That's wonderful, because for so many people, and so many people that many ministers serve and social workers serve, the ability to walk into a hospital or a doctor's office and have dignity is worth a whole lot. By having a health insurance card, you have a little bit of dignity. But the reality is you're paying perhaps a premium of $99 a week if you have one of the lower premiums for people that are not making as much money. But you have a deductible perhaps of $3,500 or $7,000. And what's amazing is the deductible oftentimes includes you paying out of pocket for your prescription costs. And so we talk about making a decision about $40. Very often the prescription is $200. You have to pay the full shelf price of that, not the copay, the full shelf price. So for many people of color who have chronic diseases, they need their high blood pressure medicine. They need cholesterol medicine. If they have diabetes, there could be several prescriptions. Looking at that, what working poor family can afford $1,000 in a month in order to pay that deductible? And so, yes, we have seen that things have changed, but we have so much more to do. And I think it's really time for us to enter into healthcare literacy, because you really have to be very intelligent to understand this new system.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because cost is obviously going to be the number one factor for people. But along with cost, it's information. It's knowing how to navigate these things. It's a very tricky issue. How do you think, Reverend, people are dealing with this issue? Yes, I've got healthcare, but I don't know how it works.
Well, and that's why we're looking at health equity, because we're looking at people of color accessing the system, where very often they have to relate to people that don't look like them, don't talk like them, don't really understand where they're coming from. And that could be a very intimidating situation. And yet you're dependent on healthcare navigators to help you get in the door and get through the system. And so really it's a very challenging situation, because there's language barriers, there's intellectual information that the healthcare system uses, language that's used, it's very common there. But for the average person, they don't even understand what the doctor is saying. When we look at the reason why the Hispanic Health Council came about many years ago in Hartford, was because a mother didn't quite understand the directions for a prescription from her doctor. And instead of putting ear medicine in the child's ear, she gave it to the child orally, and that child suffered. So we realize that we have a long way to go when it comes to leveling the playing field when it comes to health.
You're listening to a Health Equity Forum. Our guests are Dr. Jack Hoadley, a Georgetown Health Policy Institute analyst, Dr. Jeanette Ikovics from the Yale School of Public Health, and Reverend Dr. Shelley Best, President and CEO of the Conference of Churches. When we come back, we'll talk more about the results of the Connecticut Healthcare Survey and what it can tell us about the health of our state. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're listening to a conversation about healthcare as part of our Health Equity Project. Our guests are Dr. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown, Reverend Dr. Shelley Best of the Conference of Churches, and Dr. Jeanette Ikovics from the Yale School of Public Health.
You know, we say often in public health, education alone is not enough. We really need to build skills. And I think we also need to think about it taking a village. So I'm going to come back to this issue of a multi-sector approach. People coming together like we are tonight and in panels around, you know, our cities and around the state that begin to say, school systems, what do you do? Transportation, public health and safety. Even our, you know, we think about safety, about our police force and fire departments, and we think that seems quite far from health, but it's really all of us coming together so that if you do have diabetes or heart disease, as you mentioned, or better yet, if you don't but might be at risk, and the recommendation is you need to lose some weight, you need to get out and walk. But if you don't feel safe in your community, or if you're working three jobs just to make ends meet, that prescription for physical activity isn't going to happen.
But Reverend, how do we get these different systems involved? Because there are many systems in what we'll call the safety net, where their task is to do these very things. But whether you talk about police, public safety, transportation, any of our systems that go into making, say, an urban area go and flow, many of them are not aligned to any of these ideas at all. How do we begin to pull some of these things together?
I think it's really all about collaboration. And when I take a look at what's happened in Connecticut over the course of the last decade that the Conference of Churches has been involved in health equity work and health ministry, what's happening now is everyday people are getting involved in the health conversation, where instead of being recipients of health care, we're starting to be actors in our health. And so you're starting to see churches have health ministries where they're offering yoga, or community-based organizations offering classes and education, so that way people can learn how to have a quality of life. And I think the time has come for more and more people to be aware of how they take care of themselves. It's really a public health model that people pay attention to how they live and how they might have a better quality of life. And I think I see a shift in that conversation and those actions now, especially throughout the greater Hartford area. There's a lot more players coming together to do work together to improve the quality of life of people. So we're paying attention to things at the city level, looking at how we can have fresh produce in the city, for example, instead of having the food desert. So you see groups working on things like that. You see groups working on what kind of activities can we have so people can get out of their house and be safe. You're seeing arts organizations be involved in it. You're seeing healthcare organizations. You're seeing in the schools the opportunity for young people to have some physical activity. So I think the conversation's happening. Collaborations are beginning. I think since we're at a funding event, it's an opportunity for funders to look at funding in a different kind of way, that collaborations be funded and not single sector grants all the time, that it's all about bringing people together, that we might share and leverage assets.
It's something in our last forum where we were talking about the impact of the Affordable Care Act and what we thought it would mean for health equity in Connecticut. One of the things I know I raised and I felt very strongly about is we can pat ourselves on the back in Connecticut all we want for being one of the leaders in the nation as far as getting people signed up for what we call Obamacare. But we've built this massive infrastructure. We've trained people to go in and talk to people about health care. We have this whole new workforce. And if that just drops off the face of the earth, when this is all done, and we've signed people up and we go, thank goodness that's over, then we have lost not only this great opportunity, but all this knowledge and workforce. And I think that that's something that around the nation people need to grasp, Jack. This is a transformational opportunity that just seems like it could pass us by if we don't expand on what's happening right now.
I think that's really true. And in some of the other work I've been doing, we've been interviewing some of those people who have been signing people up for the Affordable Care Act, and you know they're having an involvement with a member of the community for, you know, at the very least 30 minutes and often 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours as they teach people how to sign up for health insurance. And I think, you know, those are people who are newly engaged in the community in a new way, and they could be part of that workforce to train people how to use their health insurance, how to use the healthcare system, and then ultimately go well beyond that to using all the other parts of the system that really go to making people healthier.
We're talking about how healthy Connecticut is and some of the findings of a new Connecticut healthcare survey. This is Where We Live, and it's a health equity forum that we're taping in front of a live audience here at the Chase Family Studios at the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network. And we do have some folks in the audience who'd like to join the conversation. Hi there, what's your name? Stand up so I can see you.
Hi, my name is Larice Harvey. I'm from A Better Way Foundation.
Hi, what's your thought?
My thought is, in urban and rural and poor, you know, communities, is there any cross-section in the conversation about the criminal justice system and how the criminal justice system has been the answer to equalizing health in those same communities? And when you did the survey, was that even a question of consideration? Because that same population of people feel, we call them at a better way, incarcerated communities. They don't trust the fire department. They don't trust the police department. They see them as a threat. So I have two questions. I'm sorry. One, did you consider the criminal justice system when you did your survey? And number two, how do we partner with entities like education systems, police department and stuff when they are a threat to those who don't have equal health?
Well, I just want to jump in that one thing we do have to recognize is that people do have better health care in the prison system than they do out here. And that's a tragedy. That in some ways you have to go to prison in order to have mental health services because the system now will arrest you. If you have a mental health outburst, you'll be incarcerated, and then you get your meds again. I mean, so we're looking at a broken system. And sadly, there is a large population of people that are getting their health care through that system. So we do have to transform it, especially when it comes to mental health issues. And when we look at the reality that when it comes to substance abuse issues in the United States, people that are addicts end up in prison instead of in treatment. And right now, with health care reform, you still can't easily go to treatment on your insurance plan. So we have to look at the fact that those same people will be back in the criminal justice system for their mental health issues or their substance abuse issues, and that's a tragedy in the United States.
Well, one of the stories that we did on WNPR is actually about if you're on parole or probation, you know where you go to get your health care is you go back to prison. You actually go back into prison behind the walls you just left in order to go see your doctor, and something about that seems not quite right.
Absolutely. I think that part of the innovations that we can be working toward is identifying those critical moments in people's lives. So that moment of reentry, there really is a before, a during, and an after. And I think that provides a critical opportunity for change. Another place that I think is critically important that we work in is pregnancy. Again, for many, it's the first time that women, young women, or middle-aged women are connected to the healthcare system routinely, and they're highly motivated. I've never met a woman, young or old, rich or poor, white, black, or brown, who didn't want to have a healthy baby. And so these moments of opportunity, be they a joyful moment, a crisis moment, are places where we can leverage resources to make change.
But I want to touch on that one more time with people that are coming out of prison, especially if you have a felony in Connecticut. So that young man that comes out with a felony needs to get a job, especially if he happens to be a father. The clock is ticking. He's got to now pay his child support or he's going to go back to jail. So he has to somehow get a job, but he has felonies. He's got to pay child support. How is he also going to get health insurance? And so thus we see a good reason to go back, and that's tragic.
I want to get to another few questions here for this panel because we're going to be shifting a conversation to children's health. Any more thoughts or questions from the audience? I'd love to hear. Hi there. What's your name?
Hi, Mark Abraham at Data Haven. I'm also a fellow in racial equity at the Kellogg Foundation in Michigan. And I really wanted to say I appreciated what Reverend Best said about dignity and the importance of that. There's a lot of international work on well-being and how the key determinants are food security, having food on the table, having a job, and good health. And with employment, it's interesting. It's not just about having a job, but the sense that you can get a job, that you're included in the workforce if you'd like to be, either, you know, part-time. We have a lot of marginalized communities in Connecticut, as the other speaker pointed out. I'm just curious your thoughts on the survey. When it comes to health, how will the survey measure that ACA has had an impact in terms of creating that shared sense of destiny in our communities, the sense of dignity, both at an individual level as well as the community level? Thank you.
I would say that part of what we need to look at is getting some feedback from the so-called clients or those that are receiving services, and perhaps having some different questions that are looking at people who are entering this healthcare system now. What does it feel like? How did you receive the service? Did you feel that your physician looked you in the eye and engaged you in your health care? Did you feel like a recipient or did you feel like an actor? So there's a lot of shift that has to happen. And so we need to have questions that are going to be more personalized to humans, human beings that are receiving services and getting that feedback from people.
You know, as a researcher, you know, I think a lot about different kinds of data and information. And there are questions on this survey about some of the ways people are respected and is the care you get and your relationships with your doctors done in a culturally sensitive way and some things like that. So we do have some baselines that it will be important to monitor. But there are certain kinds of things, these stories, that you really don't get well in a survey. And it's why survey is just one element of research, and that gets supplemented with stories that you may get by going out and doing longer kinds of interviews, doing focus groups with people. It's really the way we try to understand how people experience the healthcare system through a lot of different research approaches, and only with all of that will we really understand how and if the kinds of changes that our country is going through and that the state is going through, is it really making a difference?
Dr. Jack Hoadley is with Georgetown Health Policy Institute. Thank you so much for making the drive up and joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks also to Dr. Jeanette Ikovics from the Yale School of Public Health. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Reverend Dr. Shelley Best from the Conference of Churches. Thank you so much, Reverend.
Thank you.
This is our Health Equity Forum here on WNPR's Where We Live. We're talking about some of the findings of the Connecticut Healthcare Survey. When we come back, well, we've been asking how healthy is Connecticut. Now we're going to be asking how healthy are Connecticut's children. That's our conversation, Where We Live, right after this break. Live from the Chase Family Studio at Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network, this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. This is our third Health Equity Forum, a project we've been working on with the Connecticut Health Foundation. Today we're asking, how healthy is Connecticut? The Connecticut Healthcare Survey, which is a huge undertaking, a series of thousands of interviews of people around Connecticut from the Aetna Foundation, Children's Fund of Connecticut, Connecticut Health Foundation, Donahue Medical Research Foundation, the Foundation for Community Health, and Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. They came together to put together a data set that helps tell us a little bit more about how healthy the state is, not just how many people signed up for Obamacare, which is something we talk an awful lot about, but how healthy are we really, and how healthy are we moving into the future. I want to welcome into our discussion Dr. Lisa Honigfeld, who's with the Children's Fund of Connecticut. She's author of a Children's Policy Brief. She's also Vice President for Health Initiatives, Child Health and Development Institute. Dr. Honigfeld, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So first of all, I want to ask you what I asked our other researchers. What part of this did you play? Tell me about your role in this healthcare survey.
I reviewed the findings and the raw data that came from the a little over 831 parents reporting on their children's health and their children's utilization of health care. I looked at those in the perspective of what we call a medical home. I did that because I think for children's health care that the primary care arena is really most important. Children aren't going anywhere unless they've been to a primary care provider. They're not going to child care. They're not going to camp. They're not going to school. They're not going anywhere until they've seen their a primary care provider. So I looked at the results from those interviews in that perspective.
What are the things that jumped out at you when you looked at all those interviews? What did you see?
So number one, we are really doing some great things in Connecticut in terms of ensuring that children get pediatric primary care. I think that's largely a result of a really excellent Medicaid program, as well as, you know, we have to give credit to schools, to child care centers, to all those, you know, our last panel talked about all those sectors, to really all those sectors to providing health services or linking children to health services. So that was our first finding. That was just great. Insurance. We talked a lot about insurance in the last panel. So our kids in Connecticut have insurance. They have insurance. They have a usual source of care. They also, kudos to Connecticut, they use dental services a lot more frequently than,
And that's a big deal for kids.
Linda Ferraro from our Department of Public Health put an enormous, Connecticut Health Foundation put an enormous amount of time into ensuring that children receive preventive dental services. And indeed, we saw in this survey that they do. So that was another fabulous finding. We're also very, for the most part, children in Connecticut are very healthy. The childhood health conditions that they have are things that are largely expected, things like asthma, their attentional orders, things we pretty much sit on the national average for a lot of these. One concerning health finding is that 44% of parents reported that their children are either overweight or obese. I don't think that's surprising. It certainly is in line with the national average, but that's concerning here for Connecticut.
Let's hear from Judith Myers, as Executive Director of the Children's Health Development Institute. And thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Could you just expand briefly on what we do know about the health of Connecticut's children, specifically kids who come from minority communities?
Well, certainly we were talking about overweight and obese children, and we do know, not from the survey, but from other reports through the Department of Public Health and other findings, that the rates are much higher among children who live in families, Hispanic families and African-American families. The same for asthma. Even the mental illness, there were some reports in this survey about attention deficit disorder, and we have clear understanding that those rates are, that there are clear disparities and those rates are much higher, and there are lots of reasons for that, some of which were talked about in the last panel, that have to do with two generational issues. We're looking right now actually at the obesity issue. It really is a cross generation. You can't just talk about the children without talking, excuse me, about their parents and the communities in which they live and what's available to them in terms of food sources, in terms of information about healthy eating, about breastfeeding, for instance, in very young children. So we know the dynamics that can lead to good health, but oftentimes those populations in those communities don't have access to the drivers that will really help them grow up healthy.
I want to welcome into our conversation Dr. Robert Zavosky, who's a pediatrician and medical director of the Connecticut Department of Social Services. We talked about the safety net during our last panel discussion. You're the safety net, right?
I'm a part of it, yes.
Yeah, you're a part of it. I guess I'm wondering, but before I ask you about some of your thoughts about this, about the survey, about the role of the state, about the state as a safety net. It's one of the things that we talked with Jack Hoadley about in the first panel discussion, about how the state plays this role in people's health, and it's a very, very important role. It's different for everyone. There's an awful lot of money expended, and we talk about it at budget time all the time. But at the end of the day, there's a huge role that the state plays in making sure that people don't fall through the cracks and they have the health care they need. Talk a bit about that role that you play at DSS.
Well, I'm the medical director, so I'm in charge of the quality of the care, not so much the cost, although I have to be concerned about that. Right now, we take care of almost 700,000 people now in Connecticut, and we also are providing the health care for 1 in 4 children now in Connecticut. So we're a big part of the safety net.
When we heard earlier from Dr. Honigfeld that by and large Connecticut's children are healthy and we seem to be getting kids health care, talk about that. Talk about how we treat kids and how we help kids through the Department of Social Services through your office.
Well, it's not through my office because I can't see all of them.
Fair point.
The Connecticut's Husky program has been well known for many years for improving access to care for children. We have moved away. We're the one state that is no longer a managed care model. We've taken that away so that the state is primarily responsible for the cost of those kids. We have moved forward on a person-centered medical home program. Our intent is to make sure that each of the 700,000 folks that we care for has a medical home that they identify, they choose, and that we make sure that the information about their health and their health care gets to their provider.
Let me welcome into the conversation Evelyn Richardson. She's a mother, she's a community advocate and an organizer. And when we talk about stories of health care, especially stories of children's health care, I think it's important to bring in Evelyn's voice. First of all, welcome to our show. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Could you tell us your story? You have a few kids.
Yeah, and I have quite a few stories, so I'll find one.
Tell me what got you interested and invested in this idea of health care. I mean, why is this so important to you, this topic that we're talking about tonight?
That was asked of me a few years back when I was interviewing for the fellows at the Connecticut Health Foundation. And as I sat there, they asked me, why are you passionate, or do you have a passion about health equity? Certainly, I was just learning what it meant. But I came up with a story of my daughter who was born with eczema. She had eczema, and I would take her to the clinic all the time, and the medication that they was giving her wasn't working. So she had gotten to the point where she would scratch big holes into her skin. Mm-hmm. She never had rest, and this actually took place for many years. I think she was about 8 when it finally did subside. But I remember bringing her to the doctor when I used to have to wrap her up like a mummy. You know, she would stand like this at night. She wouldn't sleep by herself. I had to hold her. And I brought her to the clinic again, and they called DCF on me and accused me of literally digging holes in her skin for her. And so they came out, and after a while, it was like, well, you must not be giving her the medication. I gave her the medication. I followed the regimen. She had grown. What they determined later is that her body had built up a tolerance to the medication, so nothing was working for her. When I would always bring her to the doctor, there was nothing that they gave her that worked, and I couldn't figure out because prior to that experience, I thought doctors really knew what they were doing. That if, no offense for you doctors out there. So I was, you know, caught in a really confusing place, not being able to help my child. And it was years later, you know, she kind of calmed down after her 8th year. And it was about 12 years old, it started back up. And I brought her to the emergency room. And I tell you, by the grace of God, it was a doctor there that was volunteering his services from an allergy place. And when he seen her, he said, you know, he let the doctors at the hospital take care of their business. But he came to me and gave me his business card and said, Miss Richardson, bring her to my office tomorrow. And I brought her there, and he gave her a medication that worked. And I didn't understand why for 8 years my community clinic could not prescribe something for her that worked. So health equity became very important to me when I realized what it was and how valuable a parent's voice can be to that. Because when you go out into your community, I don't know what their reasons. Maybe it was the cost. Maybe this doctor, you know, had resources to be able to give her something that worked with her medical card at that time, but it took her 8 years of suffering to get there.
But this is important because, so here's someone in the community who needs help for her daughter, isn't able to get that help, assumes, as you said, Evelyn, the doctors know what they're doing. Well, doctors do know what they're doing, but they don't always know exactly what they're doing in every particular situation. I'd love to hear your thoughts about her story.
It's not an unusual story. I think we have to do better. We have to do better by all of our children. We have to look at these problems. And I came to Connecticut to do injury prevention research. And one of the things we used to say in injury prevention is if you can predict it, you can prevent it. Mm. There's a lot of things that we're hearing about today that we can predict. How are we doing about preventing them? And the answer to that is I don't think we're doing terribly well. We're doing better. We're working at it, but we've got some work to do.
Dr. Honigfeld?
These are interesting comments from my colleagues, and they lead me to go back and rethink some of the findings from the survey. One being that although people are getting to healthcare and they're getting their healthcare services, it does not appear that providers are asking them about their barriers to care.
And Evelyn, I know that that story you told is it represents one of the challenges that parents have, but maybe you can talk about some of the others. I mean, when you have to navigate this world of health insurance, actual health care, right, and working and taking care of kids, I know that there are a number of challenges, but what are some of the things that come to mind?
Another one that maybe a few months back, I heard one of the people from the panel prior to us mention that cost was a high reason for a lot of people not, you know, getting care. And I have to, unfortunately, I don't have a global perspective of children's health care. I usually look at it through the lens of 7 children, 9 grandchildren, and about 30 kids and the daughters of Eve.
That's a pretty big lens as it is.
So, and
almost as many as
so I say, okay, when I listen to the stories of the woman and the few fathers that we have involved in our group, it's a lot of offense are keeping them from getting the child care. Because I'm good at that, but getting the health care for their children. One parent shared that while she was in the office, that she was confused, and instead of scratching her head, she scratched her breast, and it turned the doctor off, so she didn't go back for care. Another person mentioned that they keep asking me the same questions over and over every time I go there. Didn't I tell them the last time that I had a infection 20 years ago? Do I have to say I had an infection every time I go to the doctor? And they don't go back to the doctor to the next year. And I have even one of my own experiences, and I laughed with the Connecticut Health Foundation about this before. I have 4 children with asthma, 1 with an allergy, and 2 with eczema. So I go into the clinic, and for the life of me, one of my sons, he's mosquito bit up and down. So the doctor, he's, you know, kind of telling me, you know, what I have to do. I'm like, oh, my goodness, I'm like 50 with 7 kids. You know, I done been here. Can we hurry up through this process without being rude? So he's talking to me like, you know, maybe I was born yesterday. So I pull out my packet because I was graduating from the fellows in a couple of weeks. I pulled out my Connecticut Health portfolio package and just started reading it. Then when the doctor looked at me reading that, so he started asking me about that. Do you know that he gave me a direct referral after he seen that I might have known something even though I lived in the north end of Harvard? So these type of things are becoming an offense to some of the families, and instead of them going right back to their next appointment, which might be 2 weeks later, they're saying, I don't want to deal with them people yet.
Well, I just wondering if I don't know, doctor, if you just want to pick up this communication piece once again. This seems to be coming through. It's a thread in some of our conversation, just the ability to talk with people where they are and be able to communicate with them as patients, know as much as they possibly can about it. We've done programs about trying to get doctors, physicians across the board to be a little bit more caring and listening at times, but there's an awful lot of patients to see. I mean, it's a big issue, I think.
Well, when I was back at the Children's Hospital, I counted one time, and for me to be able to speak to all of my patients, I would have had to have spoken 14 languages.
That's right.
And as you can see, I struggle with English as it is.
You're doing very, very well.
I don't think doctors are terribly happy about the way they're communicating either, because they feel that they have to see too many patients.
And I think, Dr. Honigfeld, this is a big part of the earlier discussion when we talk about the Affordable Care Act. It's great. We've got more people into the healthcare system. All these Medicaid patients showing up. Now there's people lined up at doctor's offices. We don't have as many primary care physicians as perhaps we need. So doctors are overworked. Pediatricians are very overworked right now.
They are. You know, one of the concepts that we need to think about and is definitely included in the Affordable Care Act is this idea of working at the top of your license. And that suggests that there are, it's not just doctors, there are a lot of healthcare providers in our system who are very, very capable. They're trained, they're experienced to provide primary care and even beyond. They're nurses, they're nurse practitioners, they're physician assistants. We've gotten tremendously dependent on specialists in our healthcare system. They're expensive, there aren't enough of them either, especially pediatric specialist.
We're running a bit low on time, but we've got a few questions from our audience. Hi there, what's your name?
Enzinga Shani, and I'm in Hamden. And I wanted to go back to the question of health literacy. I think one of the gaps we have is, and maybe the funders can think of a way to address this, is to also educate consumers about using the healthcare system. Because between December and March of this year, I worked very hard with 2 groups, a group of self-employed people and a group of people, poor people from the community who were not covered. And the group, most of whom were eligible for Medicaid, but didn't want to go and register because of negative interactions they've had, it took everything to convince them that this is in their best interest to do so. And they're just stories about things, what they have seen as being insults or being treated less than, and all this, and they walk out and decide not to go back. And I, you know, so I think that's the piece we really need to do. Help people to understand how to use a system and not to be so maybe hyper-reactive to the slights, but also educate caregivers, providers, about treating people like human beings. And don't refer to someone in this stretcher as this one here says, you know, she took so-and-so.
Thank you very much for that. I'd just like to ask Evelyn Richardson to just give us a last word on this. As we see this enormous set of data and all this information about the health of Connecticut and the health of Connecticut's kids, what are some things you think that we need to be thinking about, especially as communicators of these ideas? We have a lot of these conversations about health and health equity, and hopefully the word gets out a little bit. But what's an idea you want to leave us with, perhaps?
Oh, that's a tough one, because all of you guys have been looking at that for years. A thought that I would want to leave you with on it is certainly, we talk a lot about, I wanted to share with you all, I'm a transportation counselor for CREC in the day and afternoon. So when I was thinking, I was like, what am I going to talk to these people about on WNPR? So I looked at the program, so I turned around and I asked a couple of kids behind me on the bus. One was an African-American girl, and the young lady sitting next to her was a young Caucasian. So I asked the African-American girl, you know, how old are you? She said, 14. I said, how do you think children's health is in Connecticut? She said, oh, terrible, you know. So I said, oh, okay. So I turned to the Caucasian young lady, and I asked her how old she was. She said, 12. And I said, well, how is children's health in Connecticut? She says, well, and she's a slender young lady. The other lady was medium build. She said, well, I guess it's okay. It's just a lot of obesity around. The thing that I found interesting is that these two students that came from Hartford Middle Magnet, you know, they bus out to New Britain, Connecticut, and they live in the same community. But they seen children's health in Connecticut a bit different. They seen it through a different lens. So therefore, that brings me back to some of the literature that I was, you know, glancing over so I can know what you guys were going to be talking about. And I looked at how the statistical information was computed and who were the people that reflected that information. So here I see whites, this many people, Hispanic, this many people, black at a terrible 9%, African-American, and then I think for Asians it was even down to 4%. So I said, well, how are they going to address health in the people that I see every day are black and brown people? How are we going to be reflected in that statistical information to really get us the quality access to health? Because to be honest with you, my children still get husky. So the Affordable Care Act really doesn't touch me right now, because they're going to get that care. And I think I need to use it a little bit more, because we don't know all of the services, so we don't get to tax you too much for our, you know, insurance. But how does that quality, what we need at the grassroots level is not the affordability, but the quality. Mm-hmm. So I would like to leave you all with that.
Evelyn Richardson is the founder of Daughters of Eve. She's a mother. She's a community advocate and organizer. Evelyn, thank you so much. I really appreciate
You're welcome. Thank you all.
And thanks to Dr. Robert Zavosky, who's a pediatrician, but he's also medical director of the Connecticut Department of Social Services. Thank you, sir, for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And thanks to Dr. Lisa Honigfeld, who's with the Children's Fund of Connecticut. She's author of the Children's Policy Brief as part of this data set. She's also vice president for Health Initiatives, Child Health and Development Institute. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Tess Aronson. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. A special thanks to Elizabeth Krause and Marilyn Greer and everyone at the Connecticut Health Foundation for their extensive help and support. Thanks also to Spice Catering Group from Durham. I want to thank Katie Ginther, Jane Marino, and Nancy Bauer of CPBN. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.